It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. Welcome to episode 52, a discussion of Leave Her to Heaven from 1945. I have inflicted this movie, and I mean that sarcastically because I love it, on two special people who've joined me tonight to talk about it, beginning with Lisa Schmeiser. Hi.
Hello. It's going to be a tremendous pleasure to talk about this movie. I love it.
I know. I do, too. And Nathan Alderman, who hadn't seen it before, welcome to the victim chair.
Hi. Sorry, you caught me just about to make out with someone in front of a gun rack.
I mean, that's every day in my life. Well, friends, yes, Leave Her to Heaven, variously called a film noir, a melodrama, a technicolor thriller. I mean, we can argue about what it's called just because that would take up time.
But a slow motion waking nightmare?
That too.
There's some breathtaking rapidity, actually.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. It's pretty. It is directed by John Stahl, stars Gene Tierney and Cornel Wilde, some other people that we'll get to, but basically the movie belongs to Gene Tierney. We watched Laura some time ago, and this is sort of her follow-up to Laura. Laura had been a big success, and this movie, Leave Her to Heaven, is actually the top-grossing movie for Fox the entire decade of the 40s. It was an enormous hit.
What was wrong? Well, besides the obvious, what was wrong with the 1940s?
I mean, there was a war on and stuff, and people wanted.
People were bummed about current events.
I think so. They're like, I know. Let's watch a nice, pretty melodrama. Oh, okay. Well, this isn't going to go quite the way we expected it. Let's start with Nathan because he is the person who hasn't seen it before. I think perhaps we have a sense of your overall reaction, but why don't you just start us out and tell us how you found this movie?
there's a 78. Post thread on our Incomparable Slack that tells you how I found
it's
this
great.
Movie.
It's great.
Just watching Nathan react in real time to this movie was a thing of beauty.
It was.
I had never heard of this movie. You guys had mentioned it and things about like drowning and children and you know, it certainly piqued my interest. It's sort of like if
Among
if
Us doesn't unwind by watching a movie about children. Drowning.
We warned you.
Yes. It's sort of like if Douglas Sirk made Friday the 13th is
Would watch. Would it watch.
It is a memorably bizarre film filled with hateful idiots that makes no sense. But oh my gosh, when it is good, it is incredible. And there is a sequence in here that I would put next to literally anything else ever filmed in terms of nail-biting, harrowing, astonishing filmmaking.
It's amazeballs. It's amazeballs.
This is one of Martin Scorsese's favorite films.
Martin Scorsese is dumb and wrong.
Oh, no. I can actually see why. I was talking about this with Philip because we are big fans of Scorsese. And one of the things that threads its way through Scorsese films is always the idea that everyone pays the wages of sin. Like, that's basically the theme in any Scorsese movie. When he's not plumbing the mysteries of faith, he's piteously laying bare, you know, criminal underworlds. And in all of them, everybody gets comeuppance at some point. And whether or not that comeuppance is proportional doesn't matter. The point is that Martin Scorsese has like a little bit of a just world fallacy going on, believes in a higher power that will eventually give you what you got coming.
This film does not seem to fit in with that.
Oh, but it does. Oh, but it does. Everybody who needs to pay in this movie pays. Because magnificently bananas Gene Tierney pays with her life on purpose. And then what's more damning, however, is that she fails. She fails in her gambit at the end of the day. And you could argue that... Ellen pays her life. Richard pays because Richard is complicit in the death of his brother. He doesn't immediately throw Ellen to the justice system and do like the hard and right thing. He just lets himself succumb and be enthralled to her love. And that's why he ends up in jail for 2 years. He commits a venial sin rather than like a mortal sin. And I think there's something in Scorsese that thrilled to the idea that little wrongs should be punished as much as big wrongs. So that's why I think he likes the movie so much, is it really fits in with his view of how the universe is supposed to work.
That is fascinating. I mean, this is a bananas movie. It is
oh my God,
so jaw-droppingly weird. I I may have had the most fun watching this movie of any film we saw since The Fountainhead, because with both of those films, you're just sitting there. And this is, no, don't get me wrong. This is not a film made by a horrible, terrible person like The Fountainhead is. This is a very well-made and interesting film, but you just sit there with your jaw hanging open, like, what? No, no. What has happened? How? What? Why did that? No. What is even? What?
It's so good, though. I mean, it's well made. It's incredibly delightful to watch. And I think this is a movie that proves that I could say to people, this is why I like movies of this era. Because if you made a movie like this in the modern era, it would be a thriller. There would be all sorts of blood and, you know, I don't know exactly how they would do it, but there would be jump scares of some kind, and Jean Tierney would be sort of loathsome in her appearance and scary to look upon, even as she was beautiful.
But she's not here.
Actually, I want to flip this thesis. Are you all familiar with the 1993 film Malice?
Vaguely,
heard
yeah.
of it, never seen
familiar
it.
With
it's
but
directed by Harold Becker, written by Aaron Sorkin and Scott Frank. Nicole Kidman plays the femme fatale. And the gist of that movie is she's married to Bill Pullman. And like the Nicole Kidman, Bill Pullman thing is your first clue that somebody's about to get it set up for something. But long story short, she and Alec Baldwin try to, there's like a toxic love thing going on. And there's some, and it is basically a thriller that plays out like a film noir. And, Ellen Barrett reminds me a whole lot of Tracy Safian. That's the name of the Nicole Kidman character, where it comes down to she's got this dangerous obsessive love and this need to be the victor in any situation. Because that's a note that I really love about the Leave Her to Heaven film is every woman in Ellen's life has her dead to rights when they're like, she's got to be on top of a situation. She's always going to be, she's always got to feel in control. And when she doesn't, that's when she goes on the attack. You know, so Tracy in Malice is just like this, and there is love, and there is, of course, the attempt on a child's life, and it's not a beat-for-beat remake, but I would argue that those two movies are bookends to each other.
Interesting. I mean, yeah. I guess I was talking sort of stylistically in terms of this movie is, you know, it's a beautiful painting on which terrible things are projected. It's Technicolor. Jean Tierney is beautiful, and she is, although she's menacing in terms of the like the contrasting in the big scene at the center of the movie. She's in white and she's wearing red lipstick and she's just like starkly alone and
so stylish. They did such a great job.
The colors in the sets and the bucolic lake. It's just a beautiful looking film, which is why one of the reasons I think it's so jaw-dropping when things start to happen. And the thing, it begins as this sort of, in fact, I think it begins, there's too many characters. You have them meeting on a train, but then we get to where they're all staying, and there are all these people that aren't in the movie very much later, and I actually find it a little crowded. I'm like, why do I need to know all of these people? And you really kind of don't. They kind of fall away. Yeah. But it feels like a sort of standard drawing room movie, not a comedy, of course, but not something that's going to go the way it does. And the fact that it is set in this way, Douglas Sirk is an interesting point, because the Sirk would have made this as a much more lush movie. Stahl, who did direct this, is known for austerity, and there are ways in which there is austerity in the way Jean Tierney is contrasted with her environment. Had Douglas,
I'm so glad you brought that up, because once you're done with your sentence, I want to jump in.
But had Douglas Sirk made it, I wonder what he would have done stylistically in terms of the visuals, because I say it's beautiful, but there's something just really terrible right at the surface because of Jean Tierney. So go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say John Stahl did a great job with the Technicolor, because he really deploys color to tell the story. And he especially does that with what Jean Tierney is wearing, because anytime you get a clue that Ellen is off the rails, like anytime you're like, the viewer gets a clue that she's psychologically unwell to the point of being actively evil, she's almost always wearing like a Virgin Mary blue. And what's interesting is she's always being put in settings that are warm shades of rose and tan and earth tones. And she never matches, she never fits in. And that contrast, the way he just underscores that without ever coming out and saying anything is just so, so good. Because you contrast Ellen with Ruth. Ruth is almost always dressed in a way to blend into the background. Mm. And in some scenes, the color scheme, she blends right in with the sofa, or she blends in with the pattern, or she blends in with the wallpaper. There's one scene where she's having a confrontation with Ellen, where Ellen is in teal, which is a variation. Like it's an aqua / teal. And she is, of course, swanning around this room that's done in dusty rose and taupe and tan. And Ruth is wearing like a dusty rose dress. And I thought, oh my God, they really couldn't make it any plainer. Ellen doesn't belong, despite the fact that Ruth is the adopted child. Ellen is the one who is so psychologically bent. She literally can't fit in with the people who raised her. And you just see that over and over and over again. And it's such a great use of color because you don't get beaten about the head and shoulders with it. But it's there where she's always the discordant note in every scene. Like, she's never dressed to compliment her husband, whereas Ruth, like, is always dressed in complimentary palettes to Richard. And I just love the visual vocabulary that he sets up in this film, where the story is right there in front of you if you wanted to look for it. Oh, it's so good.
I noticed that when they go to the Bar Harbor house, when things really start to go like psychological pressure cooker, the wallpaper is almost nauseatingly florid. They've got these aggressive, like, eye-searing floral patterns that create this profound visual sense of unease and claustrophobia. Mm-hmm. They really do a good job. The design in this film is awesome. I mean, I want to live in all of these rustic, modernist nightmare houses. not with any of these people. They're horrible. But the way they create that kind of hothouse sense in the Bar Harbor house of like things crawling and creeping and, mm-hmm. and, you know, constantly being overwhelming visually in a subtle way mm-hmm. is really interesting.
When the stormy Atlantic is the safest place in that setting, you know, you're in trouble.
I think Jean Tierney is terrifying in this movie. Her beauty yes. is so fixed and icy. It reminds me of Olivia Wilde. I like Olivia Wilde. Mm-hmm. I think she is an underrated actress. She's a fantastic director. But her beauty has an unnaturalness to it, a plasticity to it that she obviously cannot help. She's just that gorgeous. But there's always an element of the uncanny valley about her, which makes it even funnier when like she tries to play like working class gals. Her best casting is in Cowboys and Aliens when she literally plays an alien pretending to be a human. And you're like, yep, that tracks. Makes sense. And Jean Tierney is kind of the same way here. There is a perfection, a brittleness to how she looks with those improbably blue eyes and that perfect mask-like complexion that really just sets off every subconscious alarm at the base of your spine.
And the performance is interesting too, because when Lisa was talking about how she doesn't fit and she's discordant with her environment, the performance doesn't clue you in to her evilness until she starts doing and saying things that are evil, because she's playing it very restrained. She's playing it, and it's not that she's hiding. She's not trying to be to pretend to be a good girl and she turns out to be a bad one. She's just flat and you know, sharp edges, but in a flat way, not in a sort of aggressive reaching out way. And then the performance changes a little bit as you learn more about what she's actually about. And there are scenes like when she's with Ruth and she talks about the baby, where she sort of, you know, when she's laying herself bare, but even then, she's not screaming. She's never yelling. Obviously, in the lake scene, she's just like still. There's a lot of stillness going on there. And it's an amazing thing. And it's her performances. I think a lot of her performances had elements of this. But I think a combination of good direction of the performer and things like styling and things like blocking just really accentuate it and make her terrifying.
And the interesting thing is, I mean, she's so gorgeous and she's got this liveliness and playfulness to her that can come across as warmth. You see her in The Mating Season. I mean, she gets blown off the screen by Thelma Ritter, but everyone gets blown off the screen by Thelma Ritter. But she's got this lovely warmth to her. And then you see her in things like The Razor's Edge with Tyrone Power. She, again, there, this is a gorgeous woman who is willing to play a stone-cold monster at the drop of a hat. She's not as terrible in that film as she is here, but she is a straight-up terrible person in that film. And it's fascinating for me to see her really going for this stuff.
I think we should give some credit to the other actors who play opposite her.
Should we, though?
They also... Hear me out. I'm gonna digress for just a minute. Back in the early 2000s, the Monterey Bay Aquarium managed to get its hot little aquarist hands on a great white shark, and they were able to successfully display it in their deep sea tank. And this is a big deal because, historically speaking, great white sharks hadn't taken well to aquarium life. The Monterey Bay Aquarium figured out how to do it. Naturally, I had to go see the shark. Like, if you're gonna see something that predates dinosaurs and is a perfect killing machine, of course you're gonna go see it, right? So I went to the aquarium, go to the deep seas tank. It's a 2-story tall tank. It's enormous, and it's this big bolt of blue. And typically you walk into the darkened room because they try to keep the lights low, since the animals that are in this tank are usually, you know, a couple dozen feet down. You walk into this dimly lit room that is dominated by this massive 2-story tank, and you see like a school of tuna swimming by. You'll see a couple of sea turtles lazing around. You'll see some of the giant ocean sunfish and bright splashes of mackerel. It's really gorgeous. And I went in to look, and all of the fish that were not a great white shark were clumped together and swimming tightly at one end of the aquarium. And they were all kind of moving in sync around the aquarium. And that's when I realized the great white shark was on the exact opposite end of the tank. And all of the animals were doing their best to put their distance between the great white shark and themselves. And so they were all just kind of moving in unison and doing this wild circular swim that way. And that's what I thought of when I watched all of the funeral scenes where Ellen has this incredible grief and everybody is doing their best to distance themselves from her. Like, you'll note she's not part of any of the funerary action. She doesn't, that they don't try to draw her into social life. She doesn't have any hostessing duties. She's not included in any conversational clusters. Her mom and Ruth and everybody else who knows her is on the other side of the tank, as it were. And I think all of the actors were like, okay, we're going to play this up where all of us recognize that there's something fundamentally inhuman about Ellen. And because we're WASPs and it's the 1940s, we're not going to say a thing about any of this emotional damage and repression. We're just going to, you know, very subtly cross a room every time.
Yes, yes. It's like, you know, I know that you murdered a child, Ellen, so I'm very disapproving. I'm going to give you the silent treatment. I will silently disapprove of you. That will teach you not to kill children.
No, I think they're just going to, like, if we don't talk about it, then I don't have to testify right. about it. It would be a shame if this were to get in the papers.
I think Kelly Gamont was talking. Lisa and I are on the I Want My MCU TV podcast. And Kelly Gamont, the last time we met, was talking about how in a show we were watching, there was a little tiny detail that was incredibly disturbing, in part because the audience could make it out, but no one in the show noticed it, mentioned it, or paid attention to it. And that's how I feel about a lot of this movie. I don't know if it's bad writing or if it is intentionally designed to feel like a nightmare, but there is this so many obvious glaring things that the characters just completely are oblivious to. And you're torn between going, this is subtly harrowing and disturbing, and my God, what a bunch of idiots you are.
So I've read the novel this movie is based on. And the novel is basically an extended panicky meditation on what it means to be a man in the first half of the 20th century in the United States of America. And Ellen is presented as a direct threat to masculinity through the entire novel. So it does read like a horror novel where Richard is helpless in the tidal force of her love and her charisma and her erotic appeal. And then he's helpless to identify how she manages to so expertly maneuver his life around him. So she's taking control of it. And then, when she flings herself down the stairs and gives and you know, successfully miscarries a baby boy.
Does she also get fabulously dressed up before she does that in the book?
Yeah, she does.
It's pretty cool when you can stage a miscarriage but manage to survive just fine yourself. So, you know, okay.
But basically, like, the whole book is a slow dawning horror. And Ruth is kind of his reward for being, like, the final girl who makes it out alive. And this movie is in many ways a horror film. And honestly, I don't actually see Richard and Ruth as a couple. I feel like they're just basically trauma bonding from the experience of Ellen.
I agree. And I think, you know, because Ruth is she's set up when Ellen figures out she's an oppositional figure as such. She's fairly inert through the earlier parts of the movie, and then later on she's the person to whom Ellen confesses that she hates the child she's about to miscarry. But she doesn't really have a connection to... They sort of give you some scenes where she has a connection to Richard, but it's not really earned. And, you know, Ruth, like her mother knows and can mm-hmm. articulate that Ellen is somebody to be watched out for, and she says that. Ruth doesn't, you don't really get a sense of what Ruth intuits about her sister until later in the movie, and I'm actually sort of intrigued by that. It's like, what is she willfully ignorant? Because she was around, she saw that Ellen had been obsessed with her father before he died, but is she willfully ignorant? Mm-hmm. Is she a Pollyanna? Is she just a wasp in the 40s? What's going on with Ruth? I don't really know.
Yeah. And I mean, if they know that Ellen is bad news, as the mother and Ruth clearly do from the jump, why do both the mom and Ruth say, hey, Cornell Wilde, you know, you should go pitch some woo at our engaged sister / daughter? She's engaged to another dude.
Maybe they liked Russell enough to want him to get away.
Who would, though? I mean, Vincent Price is awesome, but, you know, he's so odious in this movie. He's just like an oily smarm factory.
I love young Vincent Price so much. I really do.
He's so good in Laura, and he's so good in this. Like, he's got blazing chemistry with Jim Tierney.
He's great.
He does. All Vincent Price is good Vincent Price, but young Vincent Price I especially
and
like.
The problem with this movie, I guess you can buy it in the sense that, you know, the dick of the novel, and really, I know it wasn't intentional, but when you have a movie where the main character is dick and Ellen is obsessed with him, can't get enough of him, goes insane over him, the jokes just write themselves.
Oh, I'm sure that's coincidence.
So I can see Cornell Wilde, who is, as an actor, he has the presence of sort of, I don't know, a canned ham or a throw pillow. But
he gets better later in his career, but he's not all that great in this.
No, he's really. I couldn't figure out if this was a good thing or not, because I was like, why would you go crazy with love over this?
Exactly.
This
right.
And then I thought maybe the point is, it doesn't have to be that you have an outstanding characteristic. It's merely that she's fixed the tractor beam of her toxic attention on
you. He looks like her dad.
That's it.
Well, they make that weird allusion to him looking like her father, which then she says that, you look like my dad. And then when they get there, there's this, does he resemble? I guess. But there's no confirmation. So immediately when people doubt the resemblance, you sort of forget it until you realize later, yes, you need that piece of information to understand her obsession.
You see a photo of the dad, and it sort of looks like someone drew glasses and a mustache on Cornell Wilde. but yeah, and also, I mean, one of the ways that this movie is just deeply wrong is they meet on the train. She's like staring at him, all like fanning herself, going, "You look just like my dad." And he's like, "I don't see any problem with this. Yep, proceeding as normal." When, you know, the sensible thing to do would have been for him to, while the train was still moving, open the nearest window and crawl out of it.
He just didn't have a classical education. He doesn't recognize an electric complex when he sees it.
Well, he's a bad novelist because he tries to flirt with her with an excerpt from his own novel, and it is terrible.
Oh, God, that'd be like, trying to slide into someone's DMs with your own tweets. Ugh.
Right?
Can you even imagine how embarrassing?
Not so smooth, Cornell.
And she catches him at it. She's like, "Oh, yeah, I read this exact lame quote that you just gave me in this book that you wrote."
It does feel like it was purposeful that they cast somebody in Cornell Wilde who was not going to compete with Gene Tierney at all for the spotlight. I mean, you wouldn't put Tyrone Power in this, who is the other big Fox male, you know, because they're going to be in The Razor's Edge in a minute. But I think somebody boring and somebody relatively new to acting, Cornell Wilde, kind of fits the bill.
Well, it's just, and the funny thing is, The Greatest Show on Earth is one of our family's favorite communal heckle watches. Like, there's so much in that movie that I believe we've had at least one incomparable episode about it, just because we had to talk about the killer clown angle. But Cornell Wilde plays like the great Sebastian, who is an exotic trapeze artist. And there he pops off the screen, charisma for days. But that's...
He does a bunch of swashbucklers and westerns in the 50s, and he's not terrible.
No, you're like, I don't mind watching you. You're kind of enjoying
it. He gets better. Yeah. He's attractive.
But,
fine.
In this movie, I couldn't figure out... Are you not talented? Did the director just not care that you were on screen at all? Or is this a really deliberate choice to show that he's just a bit player in the 24/7 psychodrama that's Ellen? And if it wasn't him, it was going to be somebody else.
Well, this movie was kind of like a nightmare for me because to a lesser degree, I have been in this exact relationship.
Oh, like, that explains it.
I dated a girl when I was in my 20s and... I'll just say, look, I am not saying I was a perfect boyfriend. I was not. I was, immature and in many ways thoughtless on my own. But we broke up because my brother, who's my best friend, he came to town. I love my brother. At the time, I was living in the same city as my folks. And so I was like, hey, my brother's coming to town. Would you like to come to dinner with me and my folks and meet him? And she just hit the roof. She was like, you don't spend any time with me. We live in this same apartment building, like several doors down from each other. Why would I ever want to spend time with your brother? And I was just like, that's it. I'm out. You make me choose between you and my brother. Hit the eject button. Goodbye. So, she didn't try to murder my brother or throw herself down any flights of stairs that I know of. But, this movie hit a little too close to home.
I can see that. I mean, I can appreciate it from the distance of many years and enjoying the Technicolor and just the sort of audacity of it. I think that's the thing about it, that all the other things draw you in, and I can talk about them in terms of how well the film is made and the performances and all that, but just the sheer audacity of what they do in this movie. It's one of those movies that I enjoy showing it to people who are not fans of movies of this era because they can't believe it exists and they can't believe they allowed this to happen. And there were production code issues with it, but not for the big scene in the lake that we'll get to, but for the issue of how the miscarriage would be handled, mm-hmm. and the reasons that she didn't want a child. There was, in an earlier draft, the impression was left that she and Cornel Wilde had slept together before they got married, mm-hmm. and of course the censors didn't like that very much. But it was mostly about the miscarriage because there was a way in the earlier version of the script where it was going to be that she wasn't going to have an abortion, but the way they were going to talk about it implied something like it. So, but murder, that's fine. That's cool.
I was thinking about that scene in the context of Roe v. Wade and, I understand there are people of good faith on both sides of the issue. I personally come down on the side of reproductive rights, but that scene, it makes you think. You're like, well, wait a minute. She has a baby. She doesn't want it. She's getting rid of it. Why is that evil in this context? And the reason I came up with was, one, she never really wants the baby in the first place. It is very clearly a means to an end for her.
You can see
the wheels. Yeah. You can see the wheels turning in her head. I get baby equals husband loves me again. Mm-hmm. And then she decides that she, once it has outlived its usefulness to her, she's like, I kill baby, husband loves me again. So there's that, the fact that it is never sincere or something that she, she deliberately tries to get pregnant, but only ever as a means to an end, and then tries to kill the fetus as a means to an end, but also that she lies about it. She gets everyone else happy and excited, and then she doesn't even have the honesty to say, this is a choice that I'm making. She lies about it and pretends that it was just an accident.
Another reason that she's decided to have the baby is because her previous murderous ploy didn't work. So we already know that she's evil, and then her evil fails, mm-hmm. because her husband isn't paying any attention to her because he's sad.
Yeah.
And
I murdered his brother. Why isn't he all over me?
I don't know. I thought he'd get over that. It just seems like poor planning. She may be evil and she may be calculating. And I do love how she can turn on a dime. We can talk about that in a minute too. That's amazing. But she's not thinking things through in terms of the other person's motivation.
She's really reactive because only reason she killed the only reason she kills the poor hapless boy is because he won't go away when she wants him to. And for her, people are chess pieces. And so she's like, oh, I asked you to leave a couple of times. You're like, no, I'd rather stay here. Well, fine. I'll make sure you never do that again. But I don't think she honestly ever considered that Richard had feelings beyond he must love me. And so his grief took her by surprise. Like, she hadn't conceived of him loving somebody that way at all. Like, in her mind, she's the only one who's good at loving people. She's the only one who's allowed to grieve. Like, she grieved her dad. And I don't know. Again, she's too reactive to be like a scheming evil genius. And the pregnancy was another impulse thing where, like, her overriding motivation is gotta hang on to Richard, gotta hang on to him at all costs. And then once it sank in that, oh crap, once a kid is here, his attention is going to be divided again. He's going to love it. He can't be allowed to love the baby. He's only allowed to love me. And she was like, I'm literally hosting the competition, and that can't be allowed to stand. Like, her calculation only goes so far, and it's gross and terrible. And the fact that she never really conceived of the baby she was carrying as anything remotely resembling anything other than a prop is the horrifying thing, because it shows that she just has no regard for anybody else's existence, period, or potential existence so much as she does her own.
Yeah, there are some uncomfortable parallels between her and a certain public figure of recent infamy in the United States. She is a narcissist. Mm-hmm. She has to win at all costs and is a terrible loser. Other people are not real for her. Mm-hmm. Only she is real, and only her needs are real. And she is so dumb and sloppy and vicious about short-term problem solving. She yeah. never thinks more than farther ahead than the next, you know, the most immediate problem. And it just keeps getting her into more and more trouble. But because she is white and rich and has privilege, she mostly manages to get out of it. This movie makes you sympathize with her a lot of the time because the other characters act so unbelievably dumb sometimes. Oh, you've been complaining, darling, that, you know, our room in our cabin with its thin walls and my teenage brother sleeping next door isn't good for us having sex. You know what'll fix that? I'll invite your mom and your hot sister.
Amazing. Like, she makes right. so many comments where she's like, the acoustics are disgustingly perfect. And I thought, what a great way to get around the Hays Code. Like, because if you're a younger person, you're not going to understand why the acoustics are probably like, oh, it's just their brother is very loud in the morning. That must be a shame. And instead, But what I love is all we establish is she doesn't like to be surprised. And they never say it, but it's pretty clear the reason that Ellen doesn't like to be surprised is because then she loses the upper hand. And sure. again, doesn't see other people as people, but she does see them as objects that she gets to maneuver around as she sees fit. And so when they show something like, you know, planning, foresight, thought, surprise, strategy, oh, that can't be allowed to stand. That threatens her personhood. That threatens her sense of self.
Now, we have established she is a murderous, terrifying figure, but also she's Jean Tierney. They go to a remote cabin on a lake in Maine, and what does he do? He goes across an inlet to an entirely separate cabin and writes on his novel. And she's like, hey, what you writing? Can I hear about it? May I get involved in your life? And he's like, nope. And then he dedicates the novel to her sister.
That knows was by this just weird. That makes no sense. And he's so warned. Dumb. Don't do that. Don't do it.
Yeah. He's like, why? Why is there? Is there going to be a problem? You mean the same woman who's violently uninterested in my work and jealous of it is going to be mad if I don't dedicate it to her? She can't be. Oh my lord.
He's a dope.
There's this meme.
He's a dope.
There's this meme that is supposed to be making fun of clueless, self-important guys who'd rather play video games than pay attention to anyone else. Uh-huh. And it is a woman on one side saying, and I apologize for the relative crudeness of this, babe. I'm so horny, please have sex with me. And then the stoic faced guy on the other side saying, begone woman, I have just ranked up in Elden Ring. And that's Cornel Wilde in this movie. He's like, babe, I'm so horny, please have sex with me. Sorry, I gotta work on my novel that I'm not gonna tell you about, and I'm gonna dedicate to your sister.
Also, it's like an insanely fast novel, because they're on the honeymoon, and then a couple months later the novel has been submitted, edited, and in print. And I was just like,
well, there's plenty of time as they travel from house to house to house in this movie. Yeah, I mean,
my sense of time in this movie is completely discombobulated because.
Well, that happens after Danny dies, too, mm-hmm. because yeah. they go to Bar Harbor and you don't know how long it's been. And then the pregnancy thing happens and the nursery happens. And so you all the only time signature you have is, OK, I understand the difference between beginning of pregnancy and middle of pregnancy when she's not. Her baby bump is not, you know, enormous. It's we never get to 9 months pregnancy with
I'm
with
hideous.
Her.
I'm a gorgeous woman wearing a slightly right. oversized coat. Look at my bloated monstrosity.
Terrible. I don't want my husband who's writing his novel to come and see me.
Speaking of that novel, it is set in Mexico, and you can just take one look at Cornel Wilde's character and know he has never been to Mexico. He has never been to a Mexican restaurant. I guarantee you that there is at least one sentence in that book where someone says, he said, Mexicanly.
Olé, he said, sipping on his horchata.
No, horchata would be too spicy.
Oh my God.
Would you like some grilled queso? They asked. It's just like he'd completely mess up the meals. It would be great.
Do we want to talk about the pivotal scene in the center of the movie? We've talked about what happens basically.
Oh, I love
but,
that
but the
scene.
Way it's mm-hmm. the way it's paced, the way it's shot, I think Daryl Hickman is very good in it, mm-hmm. as is G. Tierney, who's just still and evil throughout the whole scene.
Daryl Hickman is great. He gives this like sincere youthful energy, mm-hmm. and he doesn't even he's so lovable. He doesn't even pick up on it when like Gene Tierney is flirting with him inappropriately by posing sexually next to the crutches that he is going to learn to use. No, Gene Tierney, don't do that.
I think if Danny had lived, he would have been scarred by Gene Tierney as his aunt. I really do. Mm-hmm. I think he would have had very inappropriate dreams. She probably would have helped.
Have actually had done her best to seduce him and then claimed yeah. that he would have attacked her because her goal would have been not
send him to jail.
Create a permanent rupture, get to the point where she can completely cut Richard off and isolate him from any and all meaningful social interaction. And she might even go after Danny to punish Richard once he makes her mad. So so it's almost a mercy that this kid ends up drowning in the middle of a lake, because what was in store for him was
she would have wrecked his life.
Yeah.
And Daryl Hickman has been a child actor for a long time. There are a lot of movies of him movies where he is a little toe-headed kid, and he will continue to act. And I think I like him at this age. I also like, we needed him to have the disability so that he would be in the more helpless situation. Mm-hmm. But I like that they didn't get maudlin about that. It's just a fact of his character and in his existence. Mm-hmm. When he is on screen, he is trying to do and be as much as he can. His brother loves him. He wants him to be with him. So if you're going to throw a disability into a movie of this kind and you're going to have somebody die because they're not able to swim, whether they were disabled or not, this is fairly decent for that sort of representation.
Yeah, he's never pitiable. He never pities himself. He mm-hmm. got sick. He was in the hospital. Now he's getting better. And like he's not like, well, I can't swim across the lake. I had the polio. He's like, no, I'm going to do it. I can do it. It turns out to be a fatal error on his part, but only because he didn't have the right training and the right support. He could have totally done it.
And Gene Tierney encouraged him because this was, yeah. was clearly planned. Like, and her... I give the writing credit in some areas, in the areas of the movie where whether Gene Tierney has a long game or whether the game is just half a scene away, when she is manipulating and at first you don't quite understand what her goal is or you understand part of it and then it comes clear. And I just love the way those things are written. And the Daryl Hickman bit is a perfect example of that, because she's actually helping him do a thing he very much wants to do, but she's manipulating the scene in such a way that it's going to end his life. And it's just really well done.
You know, she would have let him cross the lake if he had been like, oh, I'll go to Bar Harbor tomorrow. Like that.
Yeah, sure.
She probably, like I said, I feel like she acts on impulse, but she's also somebody who hoards, who hoards goodwill or who hoards her plans because they're plausible defenses later. Like when she launches into the charm offensive in the hospital, much to the alarm of the doctor who's treating Danny.
Who doesn't say anything, he should.
Like he's just pop-eyed with terror or something, but I want to tell him, and he's like,
that's the switch I love so much, when she's yeah. talking to him and then she completely switches when somebody else comes into the room. That's the first real indication, oh, this is bad.
She has turned the full power of her Karening on. It's at Karen level 1000.
I don't think she wanted to kill Danny until like right when they were having the discussion And he's like, oh, I think the three of us are fantastic in the cabin. Why would I go to Bar Harbor? And like, on the one hand, surely no teenager is this dumb as to why maybe a newlywed couple would want to be left alone.
It's the 1940s. We're not even sure if he's been told of the existence of sex.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, like he's been ill and now he's with his brother. Who has a new wife who seems to like him. Yeah. So he might understand on some level that a couple would like to be alone, but his brother has clearly indicated that he wants him with him.
Also, his brother's hot wife wants to hang out with him all the time and rub him down with liniment.
Yeah. That's not a bad thing from his point of view.
The weird thing is, because we all agree that she was going to be grooming Danny if he had mm-hmm. lived, right? We all agree on that.
Yes.
But, like, the weird thing is how deftly she had slipped into the mothering role. And I would argue that rubbing the liniment on his back and then giving the encouragement was, like, 100% her lulling him into, oh, I'm taken care of. This woman takes care of
you
me.
Think?
Just like my brother takes care of me. And
oh, then, she takes care
but in
of
a very
right.
disturbing way.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just, I love it because she plays like she plays all of these archetypes at once, where she's simultaneously mothering and like she's both mother and Medea, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And she's also, you know, this bereaved daughter, but at the same time she's this calculating seductress. And the scene where she effectively like dumps Vincent Price when he shows up all Ellen, what the heck, that's fantastic, because there she's just this remote, beautiful, merciless creature. And oh my god, the scene in the lake is great like that too, because I feel like when she's watching Danny drown, she doesn't have to put on any of those roles, and her perfectly blank face as she just watches him go down, I think that's the purest Ellen we ever see.
Yeah, she tries on all those roles and none of them ever seem to fit. She mm-hmm. seems to feel like she's expected to fill them, but she never seems happy. Mm-hmm. She doesn't, she's not really a person. She's just this gaping vortex of need.
Maybe that's why she doesn't recognize other people, is because she doesn't feel like one herself.
Well, which is why I think it makes sense that she ends up purposely dying. Obviously, she wants to create the frame to cause the trouble for the people who survive. But I also don't feel like her desire for self-preservation is particularly great. She's not committing suicide in the sense of, I don't have anything to live for, but it's her, it continues to be an act of vengeance. It's mm-hmm. like, if I have to take myself out in order to revenge myself on these people that have hurt me, yeah. I'm totally willing to do it because I don't have any, I'm remorseless even about myself.
But that's the one time when she actually plans, and it's a mm-hmm. ridiculously elaborate plan.
Yes,
go to Daddy's poison basement, get arsenic, you know, mm-hmm. dump out bath salts, replace with arsenic mm-hmm. to frame sister, put arsenic in small envelope of sugar, plant envelope of sugar in sister's jacket, go on picnic where we apparently have loose sugar just hang around because it doesn't come in tubes, God knows. And ask for sugar in my lemonade, poison myself to death, ask immediately to be cremated, the end.
And the poison takes a while, too. It's
Did you guys ever read Gone Girl or watch the movie?
No.
No. Okay. I know of it, certainly, but yeah.
So I'm not going, this is not a spoiler, this is actually something that sets the wheels of the plot in motion. But basically, Nick Dunn, who's the main character, and basically a jerkwad, wrongs his wife Amy.
Ben Affleck plays a jerkwad?
It's perfect.
No.
It is perfect casting. It's the role he was born to play. And he wrongs his wife in a number of ways. She wrongs him in a number of minor ways. She gets so ticked off over him having an affair that she decides to kill herself and set him up for the murder. And this is just in the first third of the movie. And then she's like, wait, no, why would I kill myself when I can live and make him miserable instead? And that's and that's like the rest of it. But I feel like if Ellen had been just a tiny bit less emotional, or like Nason says, this howling vortex of pain and need, like she would have flipped the switch and been to Richard, I love you so much, you have to suffer so you know what it's like to love you too. And like
does seem like a lot of work though. I mean,
it She, you know, this is a woman who was doing arsenic bath salts and writing letters to her lawyer and then keeping it together long enough to give deathbed orders. So,
right, that was convenient. Her timing is excellent in various cases. So there's that. Mm-hmm. There's the fall down the stairs where she manages to miscarries, but she's fine, which is what she wants. When she kills Danny, she hears somebody coming, but she has plenty of time to scream and give some plausible deniability. Oh, I was there, but I couldn't save him.
The way I read that scene, because what happens is Ellen watches Danny go down and her face is beautiful and blank and incredibly stylish. Like the way she's framed, you could just see somebody like...
It's a magazine cover. It's just
great. You
could
see someone put it on Pinterest, all hashtag goals. And it's not till she sees the caregiver and realizes that if he notices only her in the lake and no Danny, she's going to be in trouble. That's when you can see her quickly calculate, okay, what do I do now to cover my own shapely rear? And that's when she does the... and dives in the water and sets up the scene. But I strongly suspect if he hadn't been around, it would have been a very different series of events that played out.
Oh, I agree. Yeah.
She was like, crap, a witness. I better riff.
Yeah. And so she was capable of thinking in that moment. And again, you know, she had enough time to do it. So
there are two things I really like about that scene that struck me. One is the beautiful, bright sunlight. This is not dark. It's not shadowy. It happens in broad daylight on a day with an achingly blue sky on a sparkling
lake. The lake is completely still.
Surrounded by, you know, pine trees. And two, it's quiet. For most of the film, the orchestra is beating you about the head and shoulders. But there, the music drops out, just like it does in so many great sequences from Hitchcock. And you just watch it play out. And that silence and that stillness and her lack of affect and those sunglasses she puts on for the only time in the movie that hide her dazzling eyes just makes it feel inevitable.
The way they dress her, the contrast with the lipstick, the sunglasses, I do think are a brilliant touch.
So beautiful.
And she's so still. Like, she's not even just not helping him. She's stone. And you see it play out on her face, but just her body doesn't move. And it's just a delightful... But not delightful. It's just a beautiful thing to watch from a filmmaking point of view.
And they drag it out. You know that Danny is doomed, but until he goes down and those last bubbles rise, there's always a chance that he could be saved.
Well, he kind of comes back up for a little bit because he says he has a cramp, and then he says, and then he's still for a minute, and then he comes back and he says, Ellen, help, and then we have to wait. And then he's gone.
Reinforcing the factual fallacy that you will get stomach cramps if you swim an hour after eating.
Thanks, movie, for lying to us about things like that. That's not the worst thing this movie does, but in any case.
It did bug me because I'm like, Red Cross training says otherwise. But no, it's when he screams her name and she just looks at him like she's watching, like she's watching the grass grow.
Ugh. There are so many weird and uncanny things in this movie. The silences, the way people always start to talk and then stop. The scene where Cornel Wilde is writing his novel outdoors by the world's least appealing, most brackish swimming pool. And in my thread on the Slack, I said it was the least appealing swimming pool the side of Diabolique. And I stand by that assessment. But so he's been out there for a long time, typing his novel in full view of the entire swimming pool. You know, Ruth, the sister, is up there. She's even higher up. She's like on a trellis trimming roses and being like, hey, you know my sister? You really shouldn't. Oh, I've said too much. Never mind. But so out of nowhere, all of a sudden, up pops Jean Tierney. It's like, was she just like underwater that whole time waiting to make an entrance?
All the things that happen in the water in this movie are just plain weird.
It really is. In the end, as Cornel Wilde is paddling back across the lake to be reunited with Ruth after his 2 years in prison, I thought, wouldn't it be great if Jean Tierney just like popped up out of the water like Jason at the end of Friday the 13th to try to kill him? It'd been so perfect.
But you will never have my sister.
Also, Lisa has noted the color scheme of Jean Tierney's outfits, but no, Jean Tierney is stunning and she's fabulous, but other than the red swimsuit she wears as her like post-miscarriage celebratory got my pre-baby body back look.
Oh, I love that suit. She's a scarlet woman. Oh,
yeah, it's fantastic and she looks great in it, but a lot of her other clothes are kind of ugly. And she was married to the guy who designed them. I'm sorry, but you do not dress your wife, a movie star, in a powder blue and, what is it, puce combination kimono and drum majorette outfit.
Oh.
I mean, it does clearly signify that one of them is in mourning and one of them is not, but...
The styles are very of the time too, like all of the silhouettes and things like that. So I think some of what sits oddly on our eyes is simply the costume designer trying to convey that despite there being a war and fabric rationing, here is somebody who had long sweeping skirts and extremely stylish hats and clearly did not have to wear shoes with wooden soles.
And she has a one-piece swimsuit with giant lapels for some reason.
Yep.
And they're out, and of course, like, and this is common, this is not unique to this movie, but they're out in a cabin in the woods, I guess, but she's wearing these, you know, flowing floor-length outfits and just, yeah, because women overdress in movies. It's a thing that happens, especially when they're married.
She does try to, like, put on jeans and a flannel shirt at one point, but...
One time. And that's, she has this weird thing where she doesn't even want the guy, Chill Wills, to cook for her husband.
I'll do all of that. And sure. What's interesting is in the shirt and the pants that she wears is they're cut in a really form-fitting and urbane style. Like, she looks very sophisticated even when she's trying to rusticate. Right. Contrast that with Root's outfit in a couple subsequent scenes where you see her transplanting those wisteria vines, and she's in a pair of really baggy chinos and a little schoolgirl top tucked into it. And it's a completely different read on how a woman wears pants and a top in that era as well. So, oh my God, the costuming. I actually think the costuming on this is really good. I think a lot of it does sit weirdly on our eyes because we're like, who in their right mind wears a nightgown with shoulder pads to bed? What are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it didn't seem odd to me. It kind of made sense, and I'm not fashion icon by any means, or nor do I understand the details of it, but it felt very appropriate to the time and to Jean Tierney's character, who is this woman of privilege. And you're right. The point about Ruth is very interesting because, I mean, obviously we're trying to contrast, even in, not necessarily in terms of wearing pants specifically, certainly not, but we're trying to contrast the two, and we're trying to set Ruth up as the person who's going to save Cornell Wilde, I guess. I mean, okay. and Jean Tierney's threatened by her and gets murderous.
And the crazy thing is, you know, she didn't have to do any of this. She could have been happy if she'd just, well, I guess she could have been happy if she'd just not had a massive electric complex for her dad, which is heavily implied and really disturbing. And it is implied that the dad killed himself because of her for reasons I do not care to speculate on. But but if she just let it go.
That would explain why the mom spends all of her time hiding in her room now. I mean, that's a little thing that they mention once and then never talk about again.
Well, the mom thing, it's weird because there's that business of the adoption and you were adopted by the mother but not the father, and they never really follow that through. The mother is the first one that warns Cornell Wilde to basically be careful of her daughter.
After she has said, you know, my daughter's engaged, you should go and hang out with her under the stars in the New Mexico wilderness.
Right, that was weird. But
I really think that she was trying to save Vincent Price's character.
Could be. She probably liked him.
But he's such a jerk.
He's ambitious and he's got a career in front of him. And she probably correctly intuited that the minute Ellen decides Ellen's not going to let that happen. If you had to read the family, what happened is Ellen and her father were unnaturally and intensely connected. Mom got frozen out of her own marriage. When she went to adopt Ruth, the dad's like, Ellen is all the daughter I ever need. So there's that schism too, which reinforces Ellen's sense of superiority. And then best case scenario is he realizes that his little girl is a grown woman who's engaged to somebody else. And he kills himself out of the sickness and shame he feels over the fact that she's his daughter.
Canon accepted. I buy that. I really do.
Yeah.
And you've read the book, so I don't know if any of that is indicated. Well, friends, any last thoughts?
Watch the movie. Oh, my gosh. Yes. Watch this movie. It's so fun. It is so fun. I found it for free on YouTube. That's how I got a hold of it. So anybody can go looking for it there. But it's just
I'll link to that.
it's just a masterclass in how to use color to tell a story without screaming the story at the top of your lungs. Gene Tierney's performance is flawless. Vincent Price is a whole lot of fun in the movie. I love this one. I'm so glad we revisited
and
it.
And the reverse end of the free YouTube, which I will link to, there is a Criterion Blu-ray. So if you want to see it in its pretty best, that's available as well. Mm-hmm. I don't think there are any particular features on that one. I think it's just the movie. Yeah. But all that will be linked.
I would have loved to hear a commentary track. This movie is wonderful because it is both a bizarre film filled with hateful idiots where you're like, why are you doing that? But it is also really well made and compelling. It moves at a great clip. It's never boring. And there is stuff in this movie that you will be like, whoa, I did what? How? This movie has some sickness that runs real deep and makes it a fascinating film to watch. I'm so glad you guys recommended it.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. And yes, absolutely. Go and watch it. It is worth it. And again, I think the audacity of it for somebody who is not into films of this era or even is but hasn't seen this one, it's absolutely worth it. Thank you all for being with us for Leave Her to Heaven, a delightful film, which is also full of terrifying things. I was joined this evening by Nathan Alderman and Lisa Schmeiser. It was really fun to talk to you guys about Leave Her to Heaven. We'll be back in a couple of weeks to talk about another film noir film from this era, Gilda. In the meantime, please go to theincomparable.com/LTS to subscribe. You can follow us on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield because S's cost extra, or you can follow me personally at Shelley on Twitter, Shelly. Bye now.